From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Eric Westervelt. It's Here and Now. Let's get the latest now on the big story in Washington. Attorney General Jeff Sessions stepped aside Thursday from taking any role in the federal investigations into Russian interference in the U.S. election and whether Trump officials may have had improper contacts with the Russians. Sessions earlier had said he had not had contact with Russian officials. He said yesterday, yes, he did have two encounters, including a meeting last year in his office with Russia's ambassador to the U.S., Sergei Kislyak. But Sessions said that meeting was all about his work as a member of the Senate Armed Services Committee.
Let me be clear. I never had meetings with Russian operatives or Russian intermediaries about the Trump campaign.
Washington Post reporter Adam Entus broke the story. He joins us now from Washington via Skype. And Adam, Jeff Sessions yesterday, when asked what he talked about with the Russian ambassador, said, quote, "I don't recall, but most of these ambassadors are pretty gossipy." What do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I think what he's describing there was, you know, a series of meetings that he had in addition to Ambassador Kislyak in the course of 2016 with ambassadors from many other countries. And those ambassadors, you know, were obviously following very closely the presidential campaign and less so the work of the Armed Services Committee on which Sessions sits. And so from talking to diplomats who helped arrange some of those meetings for those other ambassadors, not including Kislyak, they said that the ambassadors were mainly interested in picking Sessions' brain on how a future potential Trump administration would posture itself towards the country that they represent. And so they were less interested in the day-to-day work of Sessions on the Armed Services Committee, but instead in his perspective on what kind of policies a Trump White House would pursue.
That's interesting and new. So ambassadors you've talked to, other ambassadors who met with Sessions said, basically, of course, we were talking about the campaign and about Donald Trump, not about the Armed Services Committee.
Yeah, I think it's less about the campaign per se. They were not interested in knowing what rally would be held tomorrow or the next day. They were interested in trying to get at the policies that the future potential administration would pursue. For example, the Japanese ambassador was interested in finding out how Trump saw the relationship with Japan if he won the presidency. Same thing for the Ukrainian ambassador. This was mainly a chance for them to try to pick up a bit of rumen, if you will, some gossip, maybe get a few details that they can then write in a cable and send back to their capitals to inform the leadership of their country where this potential future White House is heading with regard to where that country's postured.
Adam, what, if anything, do we know about these investigations into Russian meddling in the election, where they stand, who's being investigated, what?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely hard to get any concrete information on that. You know, we do know that there's a counterintelligence investigation that is being done by the FBI. Counterintelligence investigations are famously closely held. You know, the White House is not supposed to receive any information about it, especially if it concerns members of the White House. They might get some information about some of the intelligence that is collected, which is part of the reason why what happened to the National Security, former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, came out, because you know, the FBI was eavesdropping on Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, and had intercepted a phone call in which Flynn was a participant. What you need to understand about, your audience needs to understand about how this works is the FBI and the NSA are targeting the foreign officials, foreign ambassadors, including Kislyak in this case. And these ambassadors, they have meetings with American officials. And typically, if they're good at their jobs, they will send a report home, which the NSA may or may not intercept, which provides some measure of you know, insight into what those meetings were about.
Adam, in the case of both Jeff Sessions and the now resigned National Security Advisor Michael Flynn, we have a pattern of evasive answers, don't we?
We do. I mean, in the case of Flynn, we had public statements by the vice president that turned out not to be accurate. And in the case of Sessions, you know, he had basically two opportunities to disclose his meetings with Kislyak, and he did not. And so, you know, this raises questions as to why. Why not just come clean about this when asked about it, either under oath or in a public forum? And it remains a question mark, and we don't really know where what other meetings might have taken place as well.
And we should say we've learned that at least two more Trump campaign officials also met with the Russian ambassador. Washington Post national security reporter Adam Entus. Adam, thank you so much.
A pleasure. Thank you.
Well, a remarkable find was reported this week in the journal Nature. Scientists have uncovered what they say could be fossils of some of the earliest living organisms on Earth. They say the fossils hidden in rocks in Canada could be more than 4 billion years old. Joining us now is Dominique Papineau, part of the team that discovered the fossils. He's a lecturer at University College London. He's with us on Skype. Welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy. Thank you for having me.
And tell us more about these fossils that you found.
Well, so those fossils are microscopic, so we cannot see them naked eye. They are skinny filaments about 5 microns in size, but that can measure lengths of almost up to a millimeter. And we found them inside a concretion, inside different concretions of jasper. So concretions are these rounded bits of rocks that deflect the laminations of the rock, so they deflect the sedimentary layers. And that's significant because we find fossils commonly in the younger rocks embedded inside concretions, that they be limestone or otherwise. So this is a kind of a uniformitarian perspective here that lends a significant support to our discovery.
But if you can't see them with your naked eye, how did you know where to look to find these old, old fossils?
I could see the concretions in the field, although I did not really suspect nor hope to find the microfossils in there, primarily because these rocks have been metamorphosed to at temperatures more than 450 to 500 degrees Celsius. So really, when that happens, the minerals, they recrystallize, and they tend to destroy these delicate fabrics. But the concretions themselves, because they're made of jasper, which is a similar rock type to your agate in mortar and pestle that you may use for culinary purposes. Mm. So it's a very tough rock, and I think that toughness was sufficiently robust to prevent this recrystallization and the destruction of these microstructures.
And how sure are you that this is more than 4 billion years old?
Well, the other people have dated the rocks for us. This is part of a supercrustal belt, we call it. So it's a very ancient belt dominated by volcanic rocks. And so there is consensus in the scientific community that the rocks, the entire belt, is at least 3.77 billion years old. But the volcanic rocks have been dated directly also with an unusual method, but a method that's been applied to younger volcanic rocks, still less reliable than the other method that was used to generate the younger age. But if that's true, the rocks may be 4.28 billion years old.
And what do you think they tell us about the origins of life on Earth?
So for the origins of life on Earth, I think it tells us that it happened very quickly and that it diversified quite quickly also, because these organisms are very similar to modern living Mare Profundus filamentous microbes that are known to live off of eating iron. So they oxidize iron for a living, and they share many of those morphological traits. So if these emerge that early, then it may be an indication that life is quite common in the solar system.
What other questions do you still have about this?
Well, I would like to know what these organisms were eating and breathing. For this, we need to do correlated micro analyses, so analyses on very, very tiny mineral grains, analyses that can tell us the trace element composition as well as isotopic compositions that can enlighten the origin of the carbon, the origin of the carbon in the graphite, the origin of the carbon in the carbonate, and the origin of the iron in the hematite of those filaments, because we find also the carbonate and the graphite associated with those with those microfossils.
Why are you so interested in this mystery personally?
Well, I think it's a raison d'être, as we say in French. It's a kind of a reason to be. There's a reason to exist. And at the same time, I think seeing the media attention to this and the public's attention to this, I think that there's a real opportunity to bring people together to realize that we are just a single common animal species, and that we should not fight for profit these private wars that are going on today, and that we should not treat others like we don't want to be treated. So I think that there's a goal ultimately, maybe of peace, if I can do something about it. But certainly it's a personal drive. I mean, if I would be the only person in the world, I would want to do this research to understand why I'm here.
That's Dominique Papineau, who is a lecturer at University College London and part of the team that discovered these very old fossils on some rocks in Canada. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeremy.
English musician Finn Greenall, a.k.a. Fink, has gone through several incarnations in his career. He's been a DJ and producer of electronic music. Then he taught himself guitar and transformed into a singer-songwriter, creating an eclectic sound all his own. He's put out several albums to his credit, including 2014's Hard Believer with this song, Pilgrim.
Come a long way, not to ask the question that's been on your lips all the way. Spit it out.
You've heard Fink's music in the films Selma and 12 Years a Slave and on TV's The Walking Dead. On his latest album, which is out next week, Fink takes a trip into the blues.
Lona, Lona, forward. I keep moving. Forward. I keep moving.
That's Keep Myself Alone Now from Fink's new album, Fink's Sunday Night Blues Club, Volume 1. And Fink joins us from his studio in Berlin. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks very much for having me, Eric. It's nice to be back.
This is your inimitable take on the blues. I mean, you've taken some signature elements, but it's very much Fink's take on the blues. Why tackle this sort of iconic founding genre?
First of all, I needed to find my own space in the blues. I've always wanted to do a blues project, and I didn't want it to be a pastiche or a kind of photocopy of you guys' heritage, you know. I really wanted it to be a real thing, and I kind of touched a bit on the blues on my Perfect Darkness album with this track Wheels, and I touched on it again with the Hard Believer album with the track Hard Believer, and I felt like, okay, I've got some blues which is my own. I've got a place in this landscape that I can build my own shack on. And I kind of waited to do the album until I was in a space where, you know, I could do it justice.
Right. If you get a sense on this album, this is authentic Fink. It's coming from you. You're not trying to just photocopy.
Thanks, man. Thanks a lot. Yeah, I mean, I really worked on that. And I think I took great inspiration from people like Howlin' Wolf and John Lee Hooker. And with Modern Records and my other Fink records, we write it, we record it, we go to LA normally and, you know, mix it down and do the whole rock and roll thing. But with this one, it was different. I wanted it to be rough and ready and scratchy and edgy and like the records I love.
Well, speaking of John Lee Hooker, let's listen to Boneyard. I mean, where you kind of channel John Lee Hooker with a little Elmore James thrown in.
Nice.
One day bells are gonna ring, frighten all the birds in the boneyard, in the boneyard.
Your eclectic approach to the blues is somehow sounding more authentic than some of the modern blues albums you hear, which kind of feel like they're still trying to reproduce something that's gone past.
Oh, it's very kind of you to say so, Eric. Thanks, man. Blues is so on the surface, it's so simple that you can't really deviate from that. And it made writing it and recording it really challenging because, you know, you have your template, you have your framework and your bookends, and you're not really allowed to deviate from that. So how can you try and be original within this sort of framework? And it made it a real challenge. And I guess the only original element is yourself. You're the most unique piece of equipment in the studio. And so you've got to channel as much of yourself as you possibly can into the performances and the tracks.
Let's take a listen to one of my favorites, She Was Right.
Oh, she left me. Yes, she did. She was right. She was right. She was right to do it when she did. And I think about her. With the music getting loud, to the whiskey and to the powder,
Well, she was right. I mean, I don't know. It's one of my proudest moments on record, I gotta say. And weirdly enough, it's probably the least bluesy track on the record, I might add as a caveat.
Mm-hmm.
But I was trying to do this blues track, and I was trying to do a track about the fact that my girl was actually right. She was right to leave, and my girlfriend was right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I went through loads of riffs and went through loads of, you know, vibes. I couldn't quite find the vibe on it, and I thought, look, before you lose the mojo, just record an a cappella version. And I just recorded it freestyle, and then I did some backing vocals for it, just trying to find the juice. And I sent it to the genius Colin Stetson, who's just fantastic. The guy is amazing. And we came back with this kind of opus to go with this blues track, and it gives me goosebumps every time I hear this track. And every single channel is, apart from my voice, it's all wind instruments, no synths, no post-production. It's all just circular breathing and Colin Stetson being a total genius.
You produced this album with the producer Flood, who's worked quite a bit with big names like U2 and Warpaint. How did he help shape or influence this blues album?
He sees music in a different way from us. Mm. He kind of sees it in color. So he would be just trying to paint these sonic pictures with my bits and pieces and the parts that I had. And knowing that I really wanted something real and genuine and scruffy and hissy and noisy. So I was in his studio for 6 days. I honestly have no idea what he did, but because it was all kind of magical and mystical and very, very, very loud. All I know is the demos that I went in with, I thought were already pretty scruffy and already pretty good. And he added another layer of depth. He made it more widescreen, much more bandwidth, much more, the bass was much more bassy, everything was just made just edgy, really, really edgy.
I love that idea. He sees music in colors and landscapes. Let's take a listen to Cold Feet.
Walk in a vicious circle. Oh, wait,
Sunday Night Blues Club, Volume 1, it sounds like it's going to be a continuing project when you feel like it, Fink, is it?
Yes, that was a very deliberate to put Volume 1 in the mix because right. I'm not walking away that quickly, you know. It was like, I so enjoyed making this record, and if I'm going to have a side project, then the Sunday Night Blues Club is definitely it. We're already writing and recording the new Fink record, which will be more of a traditional Fink album, you know, a natural progression from the previous journey. But then as soon as that's done, Volume 2 will be definitely be in my diary.
And why Sunday night? I mean, why not blues out on a Tuesday?
Yeah, I mean, but Tuesday's pretty depressing, I suppose, yeah. I think this one comes from my days when I was working. I used to work for record companies in the late 90s and early noughties, and it was an office gig. You know, you'd get to Friday night, you'd have that euphoric Friday feeling, and you'd get to Sunday night, and then you'd realize, tomorrow morning I'm back at work for 5 days. The next time I'm going to feel like this is 5 days away. And so we'd definitely get a bit of Sunday night blues. And we also, we're kind of letting the tracks out on Spotify and other media every Sunday night, so that if you're hanging out on a Sunday and feeling blue, you can just grab the latest track from the record as we lead up to the release date. It's not a Saturday night blues club, because that might be a bit more raucous and a bit more juke joint and a bit more, you know, aggressive. Sunday night, yeah, this is the time.
Fink's new album is Sunday Night Blues Club Volume 1. It's out March 10th. He joined us from Berlin. Fink, thank you so much.
Thanks very much for the time, Eric. Really appreciate it.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson, and I want you to take a minute right now to think about the people you love. Have they ever listened to a podcast? Do they even know podcasts exist? All this month, we're asking our listeners to tell a friend about a podcast they love. You can do it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know how to download a podcast, give them a quick lesson. You'll be opening up a whole new world for them. Tell us what you're recommending with the hashtag tripod. That's hashtag TRYPOD. And thanks.
This week, the Dow Jones Industrial Average closed above 21,000 for the first time ever. It happened on Wednesday, just a few weeks after the Dow hit 20,000. That is the fastest 1,000-point jump in nearly 20 years. The S&P 500 also hit 2,400 points for the first time. Professor James Angel of Georgetown University joins us from Washington. And the big jump came right after President Trump's address to Congress. What do you think is behind it?
There's a plausible story behind the Trump bump. And it goes like this. In our basic models for how to value a stock, there are three big drivers. One is how much cash flow a company throws off. The second is how fast it's growing. And the third is the discount rate, or the interest rate applied by the market. Well, if you believe the story that tax rates are coming down, what that means is the cash coming back to the shareholders will be bigger. And that's being reflected in stock prices.
So people are thinking they're going to get a tax cut. And that's what's driving this.
Exactly. If you cut the corporate tax rate from 34% down to 25%, that's literally billions of dollars that will remain in shareholders' hands.
So CNBC reported this week that company insiders are selling stocks off at levels rarely seen. First of all, what is inside selling? But what does it tell you that maybe people who know a lot more than the rest of us are deciding to sell rather than buy?
Well, insiders are people like officers, directors, or 5% owners of a company. And when they trade in their company stock, they're required to report it to the SEC, and that becomes public knowledge. And people who've studied this data have found, These people are smart. They know things. They tend to buy their stock before it goes up, and they tend to sell it before it goes down. So when you see a lot of insiders selling their stock, it tells you they're voting where their information is. We normally see insiders selling after their stock has gone up. So we've had a big rally in the market. So it's not surprising that we're seeing a wave of insider selling now.
But does that mean that if the average investor sitting at home is wondering what to do, that maybe they should call up their broker and say, time to sell?
Well, it depends on what you're investing for. The market is always a skittish place, and trying to call those short-term market peaks and valleys is a game that almost nobody can win, especially the average person. You know, if you're saving for retirement 10 or 20 years away, I would say sit back and do what you've been doing. You know, you should have a well-diversified portfolio. You should have some money in the market, but not all of it. And if you're investing for next week's rent payment, well, you shouldn't have that in the market in the first place. So, you know, I would say don't panic. The market does fluctuate. It goes up, it goes down, and it is really hard for anybody to call those short-term market movements. But everybody makes a lucky call now and then. And so I'll give you my forecast. The market's going to fluctuate.
Well, you're going to be right about that no matter what, I guess. But how important do you think the stock market is as an indicator of what's happening in the economy?
Well, there's an old saying, the stock market has predicted 7 of the last 2 recessions.
Right.
Because the stock market always has been and always will be a very jittery place as people try to read the tea leaves and figure out what the future holds. So it tells us something, but it's a pretty noisy indicator.
That's Professor James Angel of Georgetown University. Professor, thanks.
You're quite welcome.
General Motors is making a big bet on hydrogen-powered cars. The automaker said this year that it's investing $43 million along with Honda to make hydrogen fuel cells. They could be producing them at a GM plant in Michigan by 2020. The clean fuel concept has been around for decades, but the market is tiny in the United States. And joining us now for this week's View from the Top, our series of conversations with leaders, is Charlie Freese, Executive Director of Global Fuel Cell Business for General Motors. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And tell us, first of all, how hydrogen cars work exactly.
Yeah, well, a hydrogen car is a type of electrified vehicle. So what we do is we move the wheels with electric motors, but the power that drives those motors comes from the fuel cell. And what a fuel cell is it's basically a stack of individual cells. There might be about 300 of them in a stack. And in one side, we bring in hydrogen. And on the other side, we bring in air with oxygen. And there's a reaction that directly converts those two into water and makes power, electric power. That's what we generate, the power that moves the traction drive.
And what are the benefits of a hydrogen car?
Well, there are quite a few. First, it's over twice as efficient as an internal combustion engine, which is a big advantage right there. The next thing is that it is very quiet. It operates very efficiently, and the accelerations are very fast because it is an electric drive. So we have high torque across a wide speed range. And the emissions that come out are water. So it's a zero emission vehicle. We don't need to worry about other gaseous emissions. And it also reduces the reliance on petroleum, which is a big advantage.
And GM started with hydrogen fuel cell technology in 1966 with something called the Electrovan. What did that look like?
Yeah, the Electrovan. That's a really interesting vehicle. It's actually a big blue van, and it took an entire full-size van to move the fuel cell around. It had over 2,000 cells. It was an interesting vehicle for the time, but it wasn't really practical. It really highlighted what the limitations of the technology were at the time. But it was a big advance when it was created because it was the first introduction of technology out of the Apollo space program into something in the civilian sector.
Still, there are critics, and I want to play one of them. Tesla founder Elon Musk in 2015 said hydrogen-powered cars are silly and inefficient. Listen.
If you're going to pick an energy storage mechanism, hydrogen is an incredibly dumb one to pick. You should just pick methane. That's much, much easier, or propane. The best case hydrogen fuel cell doesn't win against the current case batteries. So then obviously it doesn't make sense.
So how do you respond to people like Elon Musk?
The first thing you got to start with is there is no single silver bullet technology. General Motors makes battery-powered vehicles, and we make fuel cell-powered technology. And it's because for different types of customers, there are different solutions that will better fit their needs. And so when you talk about putting a lot of power in a dense area, sometimes a battery can be a good way to do that. But when you talk about putting enough energy on board that you don't need to be worrying about how do you get from 100-mile vehicles to 200-mile vehicles, now we have the Chevrolet Bolt that's at 238 miles, but it's a relatively small car. And if you want to go to larger vehicles that travel longer distances and they're heavier vehicles that might have more utility, that's where the fuel cell comes in.
What about refueling, though? Because how much work would it take to get the infrastructure out there so that people can go fill up at the local station with hydrogen?
Yeah, so the infrastructure is not something that's coast to coast right now. That's
obvious California,
to everybody.
Basically, right?
California is the place that it's centered right now. There is some work to put an East Coast infrastructure in. But the stations actually end up being it costs about a little over $2 million for a station. It would actually cost a little bit less than that to put in a petroleum station. So, I mean, these are not outrageous numbers. And the advantage that the hydrogen infrastructure can provide is that it gives you the ability to very quickly fuel the vehicle. So you pull in and you attach a nozzle that looks a lot like the petroleum nozzle that you might use in your petroleum-fueled vehicle. And in 3 minutes, you're back on the road and you might have 300 to 400 miles of range.
So do you see a day in America where every gas station has the ability to fill up a hydrogen-powered car?
Well, I think you will see a growing fleet of hydrogen fuel cell vehicles in places where they make sense. And again, it comes into some of these larger vehicles. I mean, this technology is not a science fair project any longer. We've moved out of that phase long ago. And so you're seeing it now come into some of these places where it can provide a value equation for a customer. And there are a lot of things that are even outside of the personal mobility solutions where a fuel cell can provide a lot of advantages. And you can start to think of things like forklift trucks are one where in many plants where you move packages around, you're always trying to get more uptime of the fleet of forklift trucks. You don't want to have the downtime of recharging. In many cases, they have two battery packs. One is charging while the other one's being used because it takes so long to recharge the battery packs. Other things that we're seeing is as you start to think about things like aerospace, there's a number of aerospace applications that make a lot of sense for hydrogen. And we're also looking at some military applications. We've got some in some unmanned undersea vehicle applications and also some tactical vehicles that we're exploring right now with the Army.
Are they safe? If you get in an accident, could it explode the car?
So we've had our fleet of fuel cell vehicles running since 2007 on public roads. And yes, they are safe. And we know this because we've gone through and addressed most of the things that are unique about hydrogen in the way that we've designed and architected the vehicle. And anytime you put energy on board a vehicle, you have to treat it with respect. And hydrogen is no different in that way. But there are some things about hydrogen that are actually pretty nice from a safety perspective. When it leaks, it tends to dissipate very, very quickly rather than staying in a combustible mixture with air. It goes up at about 45 miles per hour straight up. So a slight wind disperses it very easily. So those are all good. The way we store it on board the vehicle is a tank. It's a pressurized tank, and these tanks are carbon fiber wrapped. Actually, we took a display of one of these tanks to a show, and we went through 38 Sawzall blades trying to cut this tank open so you could get a look inside. So, they are very strong systems, and they're designed to be that way. And then we certify that the vehicles are going to be safe based on our crash tests and the simulation work that we do.
And what about costs? They're not as cheap as other cars.
Well, they aren't, not today. And, many of the new technologies start out being more costly, and that's for a combination of things. First of all, when you start out with the technology, they're not in high volume. So what we're doing now with the fuel cell is we're actually just going through the first couple iterations to design the cost out, and we've already made dramatic advances in that. For instance, the catalyst material that makes the fuel cell reaction occur is platinum. And we went from the system that I put on the road with the team back in 2007 2007, I would have been looking at a 80 gram of platinum in that stack. Now the systems that we're testing are down in the 12 gram of platinum range, and the team's been able to take even more out in some of the advanced work that we're doing in the laboratory, looking at things down in the 7 gram range. And that takes one of the major cost drivers right away from the fuel cell altogether.
So square this for me then. You're obviously developing these energy efficient ways to get us around in the future, both hydrogen and also electric cars. And GM has also signed on with other automakers asking the EPA under President Trump to roll back Obama administration fuel efficiency standards. Why do you need to roll back the fuel efficiency standard if you're so far ahead on some of these new technologies that will be very fuel efficient?
Well, the reason we're pushing further into the fuel cell technologies is, I mean, we can all see a day where we are always trying to take more of the emissions out of our vehicles, we're always trying to make them more efficient, improve the customer value equation. And frankly, these are long lead time investments. You don't do this, over a 6-month cycle or anything like that. We have to develop the technologies so that they're ready when the market demands it.
But what about those fuel efficiency standards? General Motors still believes that those are too tough?
We always are trying to make our vehicles more efficient, because if that's something that the customer is going to value, we want to be there to offer that.
Do you think the customer values that right now?
It depends, right? Some customers will do that. Other customers might bias toward other things in the vehicle. Some people want a sportier vehicle. Some people want more utility out of a larger vehicle.
Would you say that right now the trend is that customers are going for the more efficient ones, or that they would rather have an SUV or something like that?
Well, there's not a vehicle we have on the road today that's gone backward in efficiency. I drive a full-size SUV that's getting fuel efficiency that I could have only dreamt of, 10 years ago. So, these are things that continue to advance. It doesn't matter which segment of the product line you're talking about.
That's Charlie Fries, the Executive Director of Global Fuel Cell Business for General Motors. Thanks for coming in.
All right. Thank you very much.
You're listening to Here and Now. In war-torn Syria, some see hope for the future in the country's past. Syrian army units today cleared landmines and explosives left behind by militants of the so-called Islamic State in the ancient town of Palmyra. Palmyra is famed for its priceless Roman ruins and treasures, many of them now damaged or destroyed by ISIS. ISIS fighters fled again yesterday as Russian-backed Syrian troops recaptured the area. It's the third time the town has changed hands in the past year. Palmyra is a World Heritage Site. It used to attract tens of thousands of tourists before Syria's bloody civil war started in 2011. Amer Al-Azam is an anthropology professor at Shawnee State University. He's also the former director of science and conservation laboratories at the Department of Antiquities in Syria.
Saving cultural heritage should not be a question or an issue. I strongly believe as well that cultural heritage is as important as lives, because lives are obviously important for now, but cultural heritage is also important for the future of Syria. One day this conflict will end and Syrians will have to rally around what few symbols help them identify who they are and what makes them a Syrian. And their cultural heritage is going to be absolutely critical for that. So saving their cultural heritage, or saving their past for that matter, is like also saving their future.
In Geneva today, a United Nations mediator met with Syrian government and opposition delegates to try yet again to bring about an end to the 6-year civil war. Past talks have gone nowhere. Well, it's been a warm winter in the eastern half of the United States, unusually warm. But the Northeast will get a brief taste of winter this weekend, with temperatures dropping below normal for a few days. That'll give a group of people in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, who live with blindness, one last chance to do something many of us take for granted. Jason Moon, from Here and Now contributor, New Hampshire Public Radio, explains.
There's a nervous energy in this room at the Puddle Dock Pond ice skating rink in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, as a handful of people lace up their skates.
I'm very surprised that I said yes to this. But I need to step out and try new things. I can't just sit inside my own little head all the time. So
that's Randy Wilson. She's a little nervous because it's been 40 years since the last time she was on ice. And because this time she'll be skating while legally blind. Wilson is one of about a half dozen people who are blind or visually impaired who are here to make a sort of leap of faith out onto the ice. Stephanie Hurd is with the New Hampshire Association for the Blind. Her organization partnered with Strawberry Bank Museum in Portsmouth to put on the event. Heard is also blind.
And, you know, we haven't stepped out on the ice yet today, so we're going to find out what that's like together.
Once they're all laced up, sighted volunteers help the group slowly, carefully down a short slope and out onto the ice.
And because the wall's right to your right. So if you put your hand right there.
See?
Oh, got it. Okay.
And then I'm right here.
Are there any breaks in the wall or does it go all the way around?
It goes all the way around.
The first few moments on the ice are tentative. Most of the visually impaired skaters cling to their partners or the railing. But within a few minutes, their confidence starts to build, and that anxiety that filled the room just a few moments ago begins to lift.
Oh my gosh. Whoa, this is great.
The skaters start to cheer each other on. Someone starts playing music over the rink's sound system, and the whole thing starts to feel a little like a party. For Michelle Klock, the sense of relief is palpable.
The anxiety was building up. I know the heart's good because it's pumping. It's pumping.
Klock says for years she was in denial about her vision loss. She refused to use her walking cane until just last year. Now, she says, to be out on the ice like this.
Well, for me, where I'm very, very cautious now with everything, it's huge.
One of the sighted volunteers helping the visually impaired skaters today is Doug Webster. He's a professional ice skating coach and choreographer. As he helps Stephanie Hurd with her technique, the two of them start to develop an acoustic language for skating.
We're working on sculling and fishing, so if you want to try to listen to that second push, so I said to let your feet from the heels glide out and push to bring your toes back together.
Mm-hmm.
So listen now and tell me when you hear the push.
Was that your heel or your toe, though?
I pushed through my heel, so now I'll make it on the edge.
Webster darts around the rink, giving advice to the skaters and sometimes leading them in elegant, sweeping motions across the ice.
It's my goal in all the things I do in life to share the joy of skating, you know, and finding flow and letting people feel glide.
After almost 2 hours on the ice, many of the skaters call it a day. But Randy Wilson, the woman we first met as she was nervously lacing up her skates, she's still out there, making lap after lap around the rink. The nervousness she was feeling before is gone. Now she seems determined to soak up as much of this experience as she can.
For me, this is a new, like, I've spent 8 years at home, so I'm trying to literally force myself out of the house. That's why, you know, I almost said no to this. It's like, no, you need to try.
And that's exactly what she's doing, in a pair of rented skates on a frozen pond in Portsmouth.
All right, skimming by. Excuse me, pardon me.
And with that, she skates off. No guide, no hand on the railing, just the sound of the blades on the ice and that feeling of glide. For Here and Now, I'm Jason Moon in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Eric Westervelt. Robin Young returns Monday. And Jeremy, it's been a pleasure being here the last 2 weeks.
It has been great having you once again, and we will hear you from San Francisco. I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.